I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The rushing waters of the Blackstone River in Cumberland, Rhode Island, one of many rivers here in New England that crested, creating flooding across the region. Here's how one resident, Lori Lefebvre, saw it.
Wet, scary, rushing, beyond my imagination of what a river can do.
The rain has stopped, the floodwaters are somewhat receding, but roads, many of which East Coast businesses depend on, remain washed out and underwater. People from Connecticut to Massachusetts are pumping out. Here's Carol Sellum of Cranston, Rhode Island.
I've been in this house for 38 years. I've never had one drop of water. I made up for it yesterday. I got all 38 years worth. We left a nice finished basement. I came home to a mess.
So let's start off with a check-in in Rhode Island. Alan Fung is mayor of Cranston. Mayor Fung, the National Weather Service says you've basically had two 100-year floods in 2 weeks. What does it feel like there?
The devastation really is profound. A lot of our roads right now are still closed. Fortunately, the rivers are receding, but gradually we crested at historic levels along the Patuxent River, well over 20 feet. Fortunately, we're back down a little bit to just under 19. There are a lot of affected residential properties, businesses. A lot of my resources, my police, fire, public works officials are exhausted. We've had a couple of minor fires earlier where with the electric currents, it caused some shorts. So people need to be ever cautious about electricity and water. That's a dangerous combination that's still very real. And also as they're driving, not to take it, just to be very cautious and not take unnecessary risk, because we've already had to save a couple of people that drove into floodwaters ignoring barriers.
What are some of the other concerns when, you know, manholes and things flood?
Well, absolutely. Right now, we are in the unfortunate circumstances where the city's, one of the city's sewer pumping stations failed. And, you know, we're doing our best to try to get it back online, but that's a slow process because the floodwaters haven't fully receded yet, getting access into that pumping station. I know in neighboring Warwick and West Warwick, their entire sewer treatment facility went under, so they're in a lot worse situation.
What happens when businesses get flooded? We're thinking, for instance, we know a lot of trucking companies there, car dealerships. And there is a lot of antifreeze and oil and gas in those cars.
Oh, absolutely. Yesterday, I was up in a helicopter touring all the impacted areas. There is a lot of damage. And when you get a big picture view, it really and see how forceful that water is and the flow and seeing cars underneath water, and you really see the oil slick in the water. Some of the water in certain areas has a lot of contaminants in it with sewerage and everything else. People should not be just walking into it expecting it's clean water.
So right now, is water still flowing through the streets and maybe with some of the sewage and oil and gas and antifreeze in it?
Yes. There definitely is some areas within the city where, you know, the water does have sewage, and we're cautioning people to stay out of there.
What about when the water starts to recede? You know, what else do you think you're going to find?
Well, we're not sure. Starting today, we're helping residents pump a lot of the water out of their homes. Our fire departments are doing that. But we're also going into the assessment stage. I'm going to be out with my public works officials, engineer, to, you know, make sure that the roads are safe and passable before we open them back up. The bridges, we're going to have to work with the state to ensure some of those bridges are structurally sound so that, you know, cars and trucks can go back over them, because there were a lot of water damage and other debris that hit the base of them.
I'm looking at a picture on the front page of the Boston Globe of Route 140 in Freetown, and you can see, you know, the road is swamped, but you can see at the bridge all these trees and all this debris that slammed up against the bridge.
Absolutely, and that's what we're worried about, because I had one bridge that crosses over into our neighboring city of Warwick where, you know, we shut that down early. But as of yesterday, you couldn't even tell there was a bridge there because the Patuxent River had crested over the bridge, and the water had come up from that bridge up two city blocks.
Well, there's another image here, really quite something, of the Warwick Mall just flooded. Do you have a sense of dollars and cents yet?
Oh, not yet. Literally, I know it's costing City personnel, the entire city of Cranston, a lot in overtime and resources. It's just so difficult to tell, but it's easily going to reach into the millions statewide. Many cities and towns facing the roads crumbling, bridges crumbling. So there are a lot of impacts.
And for our listeners across the country, Rhode Island is the little state that can, it's a small state, but I-95, which runs through it, is the major artery of the whole East Coast, and we understand parts of I-95 have been shut down as well.
Absolutely. When I took the aerial tour yesterday, two portions of I-95 was underwater. Even today, there's portions of it that's still closed because of the waters that are still on the highway. Even in my city right now, they're diverting major traffic from 95 onto our roadways.
Alan Fung, Mayor of Cranston, Rhode Island, thanks so much and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, Rob.
And we want to thank our waterlogged friends at WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, for their help in that report. Two new reports just out today demonstrate the push-me-pull-you nature of China. Moving forward, China is now the epicenter of the global manufacturing cycle. Pulling back, China executes more prisoners than the rest of the world put together. China's relations with the U.S. continue along the same lurching path. Today it was announced that President Hu Jintao will attend an April summit on nuclear security here in the U.S. Despite China's anger about U.S. arms sales to Taiwan and President Obama's meeting with the Dalai Lama. But then there's China's dust-up with Google over internet censorship and the country's currency manipulation. So let's take the temperature of China with John Pomfret. He covers China for The Washington Post. He's just returned and joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. John, welcome as always.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be back.
And let's just get to today's news that Chinese President Hu Jintao will attend this nuclear security summit in Washington. You'd written that the Chinese, hadn't really sent in their RSVP. So what's the significance that we now know they might come?
Well, it shows the Chinese really want to continue to maintain good ties, or at least productive ties, with the United States. There'd been a lot of talk in Washington and effectively an assumption among the officials of the Obama administration that Hu Jintao would not participate in this important summit. And about a month or so ago, they basically got indications that actually the Chinese were very interested in coming, but the Chinese were quite coy about actually ponying up with that RSVP, which they finally did today.
Well, and one thing you write struck a chord with us, seems to apply to a lot of issues with China, that China doesn't have the same experience that Russia and the U.S. have in arms control talks. That this is a China that may be behind the scenes saying, what are we supposed to do here?
Yeah, and actually in some cases, along what they call track two or track one and a half dialogues with, in some cases, current U.S. officials, in some cases, retired U.S. officials, the Chinese actually express a lot of curiosity about, well, exactly how does this arms control process work? What do we do? How do you conclude verification agreements? And in some cases, the Chinese have said actually they would like to be an observer in U.S.-Russian talks over these issues just to get an idea of how it all works. They're quite curious about the process. Obviously, their nuclear arsenal, speaking of nuclear weapons, is much smaller than the American or Russian arsenals, although it's growing at a relatively healthy clip.
Well, you wonder, too, if part of that request to be an observer is about wanting to save face when they participate fully. To do it.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're very concerned that they will have their weaknesses exposed. That's one of the China's big worries. In many ways, they're a lot badder than we think they are in terms of tougher, but in many ways, they're also a lot weaker than we also assume they are. And so they have these real concerns about their weaknesses or their ignorances being exposed.
Well, we also have conflicting reports today about China and its friend Iran. China had always refused to participate in U.N. sanctions against Iran, which meant they couldn't happen because they didn't have the Chinese vote. Today, there were leaked reports that China now agrees to consider sanctions. But then, after the newspapers came out, China said, no, we haven't agreed to consider sanctions. So what's going on there?
This is, again, as you said in the beginning of your show, the push-me-pull-you idea of the Chinese. With Iran, they have enormous interest in Iran and the oil and gas industry. They have some 800 actually $80 billion in memorandums of understanding in terms of investment in the Iran oil and gas industry. So they're very much, and Iran is a really important oil supplier to China. It's number three after Saudi Arabia and Angola. And so the Chinese really want to maintain good relations with Iran. At the same time, they understand that a bomb, a nuclear weapon in Iran would not be a good idea. And so they're very much at loggerheads because at one side of the Chinese, sort of the pull-you side, wants to continue really good economic relations with Iran. But the other side of China really understands that an Iranian nuclear weapon would not be a good idea. And so they're conflicted about how to go about dealing with Iran.
Right. Well, let's discuss the thing that people have said to you is either a catalyst for change or an evidence of change, a turning point, a tipping point, or maybe nothing. And this is the fight between Google and China. The dispute over internet censorship. Just tick through the timeline of this spat.
Well, let's go back to June, actually, of last year, because we really need to put this in a little bit of context. In June of last year, the Chinese float this idea to have something called a green dam software put on all computers in China that would effectively filter the internet for anyone using a computer made in China. And that would be basically political stuff would be filtered out. Pornography would be filtered out, but most importantly, political stuff would be filtered out. And when the Chinese floated this idea, everyone went basically nuts and said, this is crazy. And then the Chinese responded to that public relations campaign by basically attacking Google and saying, the reason we want to do this is because of companies like Google, and Google is purveying pornography in our country. And Google was none too happy with that type of attack. And at the same time, over the course of those months, a lot of hacking was noticed by Google into the accounts of large American corporations, Western corporations, and also at the same time, accounts of human rights activists who used Gmail. And they were mostly, obviously, Chinese human rights activists. Mm-hmm. And Google believes, I guess, that those attacks came from official sources in China. So Google was not happy about that either. And at the same time, Google had always been tense, uncomfortable with the demands that the Chinese put on Google to censor searches in China. So, for example, if you were in China using Google.cn and you would search for Tiananmen Square or the Dalai Lama or Falun Gong or other sensitive search topics, nothing would come up. And Google had accepted that deal as of 2006, but I guess with the idea that over time, things would get more relaxed. But over time, things hadn't gotten more relaxed. And so the combination of these three things, sort of the unnecessarily and what Google felt were unjustified attacks on Google, the hacking, and then the continued problem with the search engines basically brought Google to the decision that they had to leave China.
Well, and we're going to leave the story at that point, pick it up again with John Pomfret of the Washington Post, hear how Google ran into what they're calling the Great Firewall in China. The spat continued into this week, and how some of the Chinese are saying, wait a second, I've come to depend so much on Google that, as John writes, when I lose my glasses, I look for them on Google. We'll hear more about the Google-China spat in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking with John Pomfret, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, who's just returned from China, longtime observer of that country. And he was telling us of the spat between Google and China, Google deciding just recently it would no longer censor its results on its Chinese site. It moved much of its operations to Hong Kong in retaliation. Many huge Chinese companies said that they would stop using Google's research tools. This week, just a couple days ago, Google announced that it had run into the Great Chinese Firewall, that its search engine just stopped. But then it said later in the day, never mind, it's back. John Pomfret, what does this all tell us?
It tells us that the Chinese, if you confront them directly, they will not bend. And that's what Google did. It attempted to, it very much confronted China directly, and the Chinese didn't bend at all. It also tells us that this idea that many of us and many people had in the early 2000s and the late 1990s, that the internet would force significant political change in China was overblown.
Well, I was going to say, you're right that even the U.S. Chambers of Commerce, which was really pushing for this approach, the idea that if you bring business and Western thinking to China, they will change. And they're now saying, and others are saying, it didn't happen.
There's a lot of concern in the Western business community that the Chinese, on a lot of levels, specifically on the levels of economic reforms, are basically backsliding, that they're putting a lot more emphasis and propping up a lot more state-owned companies than they used to, that they're not emphasizing China's private sector like they used to. And that is concerning Western businesses. And also Western businesses are really concerned that they're sort of getting cut out, whereas previously the Chinese relied on Western businesses for technology and for management expertise. The Chinese basically, in many ways, say, look, we don't need you like we used to. Therefore, you know, we're not going to be as amenable to your demands as we used to be. And that's a significant sort of sea change in how Western businesses is viewing China. And a lot of Western businesses are sort of reconsidering their operations in China. Now, that said, obviously, there's thousands of Western businesses that are making huge profits in China. So the general environment is good, but there's definitely a feeling among Western businesses that the Chinese view of their utility has changed. And as a result, Western businesses are reconsidering, in many cases, their long-term plans in China.
And how are Chinese businesses feeling about that?
Well, it depends on which Chinese business. If you're a state-owned enterprise, you're going to be feeling pretty good. If you're China Mobile or China Unicom, the two big companies that run, for example, mobile phone technology in China, you're going to be pretty happy. But if you're a startup Chinese private entrepreneur trying to get a piece of the rock, it's much more difficult than it was, let's say, 10 years or so. You still can't get funding from your bank. You still can't get an easy bank loan. All those bank loans, or a significant percentage of those bank loans, are going to the big state-owned dogs.
And how about if you're a Chinese citizen, let's say a researcher, or one of these people you write about? It was just delightful. I think it was a researcher who said he's gotten so used to Google, for instance, that when he loses his glasses, he goes to Google.
That's basically just an indication of how wired the Chinese are. I mean, there is many Chinese who use the internet. Basically, the internet population of China, 400 million people, is as big as the whole population of the United States. So the Chinese are very adaptable. They use Western technology in many ways faster than we do. I mean, they were text messaging before we'd figured out what it was. And they were literally sending billions of text messages to each other before, like, you know, our teenagers really got the idea of the thing. So they're sort of on the front end of the curve of this. And Google is very important to Chinese academicians because the Chinese search engines just don't do knowledge like Google does. Now, that said, up until today, except for that little glitch they had yesterday with their search engine, Google.hk, which is how Google has moved its search engine, has not really been affected. Yeah. So academicians and scientists can still get the same information that they could before this change.
Well, John Pomfret, where does this leave us, or more pointedly, where do you think the U.S. should be in thinking about China? You've written that there's a sense of a new red scare, cyberspace. China has more hackers that do it better than anyone. Education, China turning out engineers almost as fast as it's making toys. It's got more military prowess. We've seen what's happened with its economy. It's gone from cheap clothing to being America's banker. And the government makes things run. How should the U.S. view China?
Well, Americans have, especially in times of, you know, crisis, like in a way we're facing now, we always have a tendency to look around the world and say, okay, who's bigger, badder? Who's our next competitor? And so in the 80s and the 90s, we did that with Japan. And actually, we did it in the 70s and the 80s with the Soviet Union. And China now seems to have sort of taken on the mantle of kind of a combination of Japan because their economy is growing so quickly and the old Soviet Union because they're still a one-party state. And we sort of combine those two, and sort of China has now become this big, in some ways, nasty competitor. And we have a tendency to, I think, in many ways, to overestimate all their good points and also, I think, more significantly, to underestimate all their problems. I mean, this is a country that has made enormous strides since 1980 when I first went there. It's totally changed the landscape. Obviously, they have these skyscapes like, you know, literally out of the Jetsons cartoon set. But at the same time, I mean, they really do have 300 million some odd people that are living below the poverty line. They're a really, really tortured society in many ways. But Americans, when we look at China, we think they can't do anything wrong. They have high-speed trains. You know, they have, you know, tens of thousands of engineers. They're all smarter than we are. All the research and development is moving to China. But, I mean, I would just ask one question. Tell me the name of one Chinese brand. Robin, can you think of one?
No.
I mean, they don't have any brands, and I think that's an important idea to think about when we think about China.
John Pomfret, leave us thinking of that Chinese brand. John Pomfret, longtime China observer from the Washington Post, just returned from the country. By the way, his terrific book is Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China. We highly recommend it. John, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be back.
Still trying to think. Well, later today, strategic defaults. Homeowners who walk away from their homes even though they can afford the mortgage payments. We'll hear someone who counsels them. But what does it do to the neighbors when they do that? That's later. Latest news is next, here and now. It's the holiest week for many Christians, a time of darkness that leads to hope, which may also characterize the Catholic Church as it deals with allegations that the Pope, as an archbishop, once transferred an abusive priest to a new parish and was part of a church decision not to try a Milwaukee bishop, even though church leaders knew that priest sexually abused as many as 200 deaf boys several decades ago. Today, the Pope celebrated Mass at St. Peter's and made no mention of the scandal. Earlier this week here in Boston, Cardinal O'Malley met with priests and did. So as we approach Easter Sunday, how will priests handle this topic? Gerald Kikanis is the Bishop of Tucson, Arizona. Bishop Kikanis, it is Holy Thursday, so first of all, thank you for your time.
Well, glad to speak with you, Robin.
And you are Vice President of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and along with four other bishops, you co-signed a statement this week voicing concern for victims of the sex abuse scandal, but also praising the Pope's leadership. And one would say, you know, really, Swiss bishops admitted yesterday that they underestimated the problem. They told victims there to consider filing criminal complaints. Other bishops across Europe are saying that there should be more systems in place, speaking out. Should American bishops be more vocal about the church's lapse?
I think American bishops for a number of years now have taken ownership of this terribly tragic chapter in the life of the church, certainly not the only chapter in place in every diocese in the United States now. There are measures to make sure that this situation would never repeat itself.
But what about the past and the stories that are now coming out? Do you think the Pope should speak publicly about his past role?
Well, I think the Pope actually has been quite active with the American bishops. As you may know, the bishops went to Rome to discuss the possibility of a zero-tolerance policy. And the Holy Father at that time, Cardinal Ratzinger, was among the most forthright of the Curial Cardinals in saying that this must be addressed, this must be dealt with. And as you know, when he was here in the United States, certainly one of the most moving moments was when he sat with victims.
Yeah, in 2008.
And all of us as bishops here in the United States have had that painful experience of sitting with victims. And one of the things I heard again and again, Robin, was, Bishop, you can't change what happened to us, as tragic as that was, but we expect you to put in policies and procedures that are going to make sure that this never happens again.
Well, and yet some would say that what happened in the past lay the groundwork for present issues. In 2001, the Pope wrote a letter urging secrecy in ecclesiastical trials, and some say that encouraged priests not to report abuse cases to civil authorities. But we're approaching Easter, this, you know, glorious day. Here in Boston, Cardinal O'Malley spoke to a gathering of priests renewing their vows. He called the current crisis one that keeps coming back to us. He said priests should live lives of holiness. He spoke out. He said priests should hold one another accountable. So what do you think priests, bishops, church leaders should say on Sunday?
Well, I mean, I think, Robin, not only on Sunday, but in many ways, the church is addressing this issue. In fact, every day here in our diocese, we're addressing the issue through our efforts to screen countless numbers of volunteers and people who work for the church, making sure that every allegation would be presented to civil authorities for proper investigation.
That's more than the church requires right now. You're saying every allegation should go
in our
to
diocese,
the civil authorities.
Any allegation that comes forward is immediately presented to civil authorities.
And Bishop, this is Holy Week, a week of rebirth, renewal, forgiveness. What will you be saying on Sunday? What would you want priests to say?
Well, certainly Easter Sunday is the great feast in the church, that which gives us a sense that all will be well. The first priority of our diocese now is to restore trust. I think it's an everyday event, but yes, I think on Easter Sunday it lends itself to the realization that dying leads to new life. And certainly there has been a dying in the church and in the lives of those who have been harmed, but there is hope. And there can be healing.
That's Bishop Gerald Kikanis of Tucson, Arizona. Bishop, thank you so much, and happy Easter to you.
Thank you, Robin, and you have a blessed one as well.
Okay, when we come back, walking away from a mortgage you can afford to pay in 30 seconds, here and now. Banks and housing experts are keeping a watchful eye on the number of people who are strategically defaulting. That means homeowners who walk away and stop paying the mortgages even though they can't afford to pay them because their homes are figuratively underwater. They're worth less than the loans. Nearly one in four U.S. mortgages, or about 11 million homes, are strategic defaults, about a third of all defaults. And there's concern that that number is going to skyrocket, in part because taboos about walking away from a home are eroding. Really? One might ask, what about the shame, the impact on neighbors, the credit damage? John Maddox is a former real estate investor. 2 years ago, he founded the company You Walk Away, and now he counsels people on how to strategically default. So, John, we understand you started working with people who couldn't pay, many of them because their interest rates were ballooning, but now most of your clients can pay their mortgages. So why are they not strategically defaulting?
Well, they really don't see that their value is going to be coming back anytime soon, and they feel that it's financially irresponsible to keep putting good money towards a bad loan.
Well, we've read examples. There's a couple in California. He's a restaurant chef. They bought a starter home. It then plummeted in value. They can pay, but they aren't sure they're going to be able to stay. In other words, his job might take him elsewhere. Do you have people like that?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a person, a client in Florida named Jeff, and he owned an investment property. Also, he owned his primary residence, and they've dropped so far in value that he doesn't see it coming back. And even 10 years is a long time to wait for a home to come back and feel like you're just a renter. Actually, you're worse off than a renter because you've got all this debt behind you, more than a renter would have, and you're paying about twice or close to twice the amount of mortgage payment than a renter's paying for the exact same house.
Well, let's address, though, some of the issues about walking away. When people come to you, they pay a fee of about $1,000. You provide legal and financial consultation. You also, we understand, start by sending a desist letter to the lender to stop phone calls asking for payment. How do you just tell a lender to desist when, in fact, don't they have a right contractually to demand payment on a mortgage?
They do, but they don't have the right to harass you. You know, the FDCPA has set up some rules to where what a collector can and cannot do. You know, if they have a remedy other than collection, then they can call you. But the law is pretty specific in this, in that they have to stop calling you for payment.
But what about other legal ramifications? Don't lenders, in some states at least, have every right to sue you? I mean, you can't always just walk away.
Well, yeah, that's true. And, at the same token, every time you get in a car, you have the chance of, getting in a car accident. But, you do it anyways, and some people feel they'll be in a better financial position when they walk away. And if the lender still has a right to come after them for a deficiency judgment, simply they're not. And we've seen the statistics in the past that lenders, less than 1% of them come after you for the difference.
We understand Florida has one of the toughest laws in this matter. Banks in Florida have 5 years to go after someone who's walked away. You say that statistically that's just not happening. But still, your clients take the risk that a bank might come after them and say, not only do you have the money, we're going to sue you for the money, and so we end up with your money and you have no house.
Right. You no longer are a homeowner, but you would be renting at that point and saving a considerable amount of money per month. And when people strategic default, typically they save the money that they would normally be paying. They put it away or they pay off other high-interest debts. So if they were to be pursued from their lender for a deficiency judgment, then at that point they would have a little bit of money to settle that judgment.
All right. Well, those are some of the legal questions. What about the financial questions? You walk away from a mortgage, if you can pay it, your credit score is going to be damaged in the short term, and some people check the credit score even for a rental or a job application. And then that bad credit score is a mark on your record for up to 7 years.
What we've found over the course of 2.5 years and over 4,000 clients of ours, we've not heard one case where a homeowner wasn't able to become a renter or find a place to rent. Now, you know, that doesn't mean they don't have to put a little extra down for a deposit, but we've seen that it doesn't affect it as much as people think. Same with, you know, a job. People really think that it's going to affect their job, but we found that when people are honest with their employers, even if they have a security clearance, their employers are, you know, understanding, and they don't lose their job, and in many cases they can still get a job.
Well, but their neighbors may be less understanding. Let's talk about the social consequences of walking away. The value of the home of the person walking has fallen, but every foreclosure brings down the value of the neighbor's home. And it also seems somehow un-American to many to just walk away from a commitment. There was a story that aired on NPR about a woman who strategically defaulted, walked away when she could pay, and the response was excoriating. Here's some of the things that people said. We're in this credit mess because people purchase more than they can afford. They rack up debt, and then they just walk away, no thought to the consequences. It's reprehensible. I hope the IRS goes after people like this. Here's another NPR listener. Currently, I'm at about 5% underwater. However, I will not walk away from my mortgage. I have more integrity than that. Talk about those, you know, moral and social responsibilities.
The homeowner didn't create the problem. The homeowner, maybe they bought a little bit more than they should have, but that value didn't go up because that homeowner bought that house. The values in the bubble boomed, and everyone's values went up, and these homes were overpriced, not because that homeowner's decision, but it was the decision of the banks to have irresponsible lending practices and lend without thoroughly checking the ability of someone to pay for that mortgage or the ability for someone to prove assets.
So you're saying that some of the homeowners you talked to are blaming the banks, which we know helped create this burst bubble by buying and bundling and selling bad mortgages and made a lot of money doing it. Is this what you're hearing from your clients?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of our clients, they've tried to do a loan workout, a modification, and many of them have tried to do a short sale, and the lender simply denied the short sale.
A short sale. I was going to ask you about that option. That's, you know, negotiating with your lender to sell a home for what it may be worth. And you also mentioned renegotiating the mortgage, negotiating it down to more closely match what the home is now worth. You say your homeowners have tried that.
There's, you know, 3 to 4 million people going through foreclosure, and they've only modified about 170,000 of them. That should tell you that these lenders are not modifying these loans. I mean, that's less than 5% of the people that are facing this. So, you know, many people are going to be frustrated with the banks because they're trying to keep their house, and, you know, maybe they can barely afford the higher payment, but it was worth paying a higher payment when the values were going up. Now that they're going down, they're strapped financially, and they're going to be better off in 10 years from now if they do walk away.
John Maddox, he's founder of the firm You Walk Away. We'll link you to their website at oursherenow.org. They counsel homeowners who want to strategically default. That means stop paying their mortgage even when they can afford it because their loan is so much more than the value of their house. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Ah, she's back. The woman Time magazine calls Africa's premier diva, a baton Angelique Kidjo was handed by the late Miriam Makeba. Angelique pays tribute to Makeba on her new CD, Oyo, which has traditional music from her native Benin. This song is called Zelie. As well as a few twists. That's Angelique Kidjo's interpretation of Otis Redding's I Got Dreams to Remember. He's just one of many American pop singers Angelique pays tribute to on Oyo. Singers like Curtis Mayfield, Carlos Santana, even James Brown. In a cold sweat. Angelique Kidjo getting down on her good foot. She's on tour to kick off her new CD and joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Hey, good to have me here.
I understand at Town Hall you had the crowd literally dancing in the aisles, speaking of getting down on your good foot. Tell us more about growing up with this American pop influence in the 60s. Where did you hear the music?
I hear the music home. I mean, basically, the music that was played by my brother when I was growing up was a mixture of traditional music from Benin, modern music from the rest of Africa, different part of Africa, and from America, and from Europe, from India, from Asia, name it, every music was just a melting pot home. Also, all the music that I was raised in listening to, most of them were male on the cover of the album. And the first female artist that come way before Miriam Makeba entered my life was Aretha Franklin.
Well, in fact, Aretha Franklin, one of your biggest influences, both as a singer and a role model. And on your new CD, you have you and guest vocalist Diane Reeves honor her with a rendition of Baby, I Love You. Let's listen. Now, Angelique Kidjo, this is funny because I'm such a fan of your African-influenced sound. Is this liberating for you to sing this American sound?
This album came about when my father passed away, and he was my daddy champion because my father was not somebody that believed that you are entitled to listen to one type of music because you're born in Africa. He believes that if we could not travel because we were not a rich family, he could bring the world to us through music. And what? Now that I grew up, I realize that I was blessed to have the parents that I have that brought home all those different type of music, from classical music down to the American soul music.
And you're passing it on. We want to listen through a little bit of Curtis Mayfield's Move On Up. Bono and John Legend both join you on this. But it has something to do with the message you're now carrying on to your daughter. Let's listen to a little first. Just move on. And be so fun. Hey! Into the stable of beautiful people where there's only one kind. So hush now, child. Yeah, yeah. And don't you cry. Your folks might understand you by and by. By and by. Bono, we understand, is so thrilled to be on your CD. But how did this song in particular come to the CD, Angelique?
It started with me thinking about the Curtis Mayfield song and I couldn't remember the title. So I was struggling with it. I'm like, man, that song, blah, 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 is on the tip of my tongue. And my daughter go get her computer and go, this is the song you're talking about? And I'm like, yeah. So she's the master behind that song because she's like, that's what you're talking about. I say yes, because I worry for your future. I worry for the future of the youth of tomorrow, not only in Africa, but all over the world, because our greed is jeopardizing the future of our children. So how do we turn that tide around?
Yeah. We've been talking to Angelique Kidjo about her new album, Oyo. I just want to ask about, I mean, I could pick so many songs of yours from the past. I'm sure other people have them. Let's just take Babalo, which just has this open-hearted feeling to it.
Babalao is a song that I wrote because people always ask me, how did you deal with your troubles there? You have no psychanalyst. You don't have doctors for those things. I say the doctors that we have are the elderly people and the babalawos.
The babalawos, they're like counselors? They act as psychoanalysts?
Yes, they are counselors. Huh. Like, I will give you an example. Like, a young boy get a girl pregnant, and he knows that if he goes home and tell his parents, he's going to be in such a trouble that he will go to the babalawo for him to be the mediator. Okay?
Yeah.
To talk and say, okay, this has happened. How do we go from here? How do we help these young kids? How do we keep them in school? How do we help them?
I think I need more babalawos here. Well, and you know,
I agree.
Well, this is your African culture. And just one last question to Angelique Kidjo. It reminds us that people, you know, feel you have been handed the baton from your idol, Miriam Makeba, who, of course, passed. And you, on your new CD, Oyo, you sing a version of the song that we hear in the States you knew as The Lion Sleeps Tonight by The Tokens. The original African tune was made famous by Miriam Makeba. It's called Mbube.
Yeah.
Let's listen. The original Zulu lyrics of what we know as The Lion Sleeps Tonight. Angelique Kidjo, just your thoughts on that. Must seem pretty weighty to you, people saying you are now anointed, the new Miriam Makeba.
I don't want to step in those roots of Miriam Makeba. They are too big for me. I'm humbled that people think like that, and I'm happy. But you know what? Miriam will always be Miriam, no matter what.
Angelique Kidjo, her new album is called Oyo. And Angelique will be Angelique. For more on her tour, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. For listeners in the Boston area, Angelique Kidjo will be performing two shows at the Somerville Theater in Davis Square, one tomorrow, the other on Saturday. Check it out. Angelique, thank you so much.
You're very, very welcome. See you soon.
A final note, there's a bonus track on Kidjo's new CD. It's called You Can Count on Me. If you download it, a portion of the proceeds will go to providing vaccines for pregnant women and infants in Africa to prevent neonatal tetanus, a leading cause of death among kids on the continent and a passion of Angelique. So for details on that, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.